Hello and welcome to National Geographic. I'm Susan Shackelford. Let's finish up this article called The New Cold War by Neil Shea that we began last week about, well, really, I think the main message I've taken from it so far is that the Russia is quite active in developing the ports in the Arctic, whereas Canada and the U.S., which actually have more land up there, not so much. So let's finish this up. During my travels along the new frontier, Cold War analogies always fell flat. Easier to grasp was the Arctic's overall absence from the North American mind. Over decades, the U.S. and Canada had never bothered to develop their northern territories or invest in their people. Even Pompeo's speech, with language of opportunity and marketplaces, felt more like a warning than a plan, the protest of a player arriving late to the game. This attitude is often insulting, even painful, to the Arctic's indigenous people, especially because such promises of opportunity have nearly always excluded them. Joe Savikatak, the premier of Canada's Nunavut territory, echoed Marvin Atkatuk when he told me the Inuit had been left out of plans for the new Arctic. "We're happy and proud to be part of Canada," he said, "but we feel like the poor brother that gets scraps." Savikatak listed several categories in which northern communities lag behind southern ones: healthcare, job creation, technology, college graduation. Then he listed a few where the north was ahead: loss of ice, cost of living, rate of warming, rate of suicide. "Whatever's coming this time," he said, "it will hit us first. I can't speak too much about what Russia or China or the U.S. want to do or might do. We're so small and our resources are so limited that we're just a bystander," Savikatak said. "All we can do is adapt as best we can." About a week into the Ranger's mission, the weather finally broke, and Marvin Atkatuk decided it was time to shoot Russians. He and Sergeant Dean Lushman, a former Canadian infantryman who had become an instructor with the Ranger program, hauled out a sheaf of brownish paper targets, stapled them to sticks, and planted half a dozen in the snow outside our camp. Each bore the printed image of a charging soldier, his mouth open in a yell, his rifle mounted with a bayonet. Lushman called them his commie squad. The targets had been developed for NATO forces during the Cold War. Standing shoulder to shoulder at the foot of a small hill, they were the tallest objects around for miles, so obvious against the snow it didn't seem possible to miss. Atkatuk drew a line in the snow 100 yards away and arranged his troops along it. He gave each a handful of bullets, and the Rangers knelt onto sealskins or parkas and began firing their clumsy antique rifles. Atkatuk said age was their only advantage. The old rifles had so few moving parts that they usually didn't freeze. I asked Lushman, who had done several combat tours in Afghanistan, if he thought a new Cold War was coming to the north. He laughed. "Man, look at this." He spread his arms wide, taking in the empty tundra, the Rangers, the paper Russians. "What would anyone do up here? Tanks driving around, soldiers, planes?" He turned to Atkatuk. "What do you say, Marv? You ready to fight the Russians?" Atkatuk grinned from his notebook. "Too much hassle." "From a military standpoint, it doesn't make much sense, eh?" Lushman said. "You've seen how much time we spend out here just doing basic shit. You've seen how often our stuff breaks down, how much work it takes just to survive. Ain't no war coming up here." The Canadian Rangers had been created during the First Cold War, when military planners, worried about ballistic missiles and the space race, had looked at the Arctic and seen a vulnerable back door. But the Rangers themselves were never intended to battle invading armies. Even now, the eyes and ears of the North are far more likely to watch for passing ships, the Chinese icebreakers, cargo vessels, and cruise ships that are expected to appear in ever greater numbers as ice disappears. Paul Ikulak, one of the Rangers on the firing line, had been volunteering with the program for some 30 years. During the Soviet era, he had helped train NATO troops. "It was kind of a shit show," he said. a barrel-chested, tough love kind of guy with a rich laugh. Iqaluk also didn't believe war would come to the north. The Kabluna soldiers he had taught over the years all went home with ice-numbed fingers and toes, reminders of just how bad war in the cold would be. "Those guys, some of them didn't even know when they had frostbite on their faces," Iqaluk said, laughing. "They didn't know they could get even whiter." While none of the NATO officials I spoke to believed Russia would launch a war in the north, several suggested a conflict might begin somewhere in the south and eventually spread to the Arctic. Some cited Russia's violent takeover of Crimea and China's aggressive moves in the South China Sea. But many outside the military believe there's still hope for a different Arctic, one that looks less like a Cold War battlefield and more like Antarctica or space. In those regions, both of them also frontiers, international agreements and distance dampen the effect of political struggles. Countries that have difficulty elsewhere finding themselves Countries that have difficulty elsewhere find themselves having to cooperate in cold, dark, dangerous, expensive regions, said Michael Byers, a professor at the University of British Columbia. This necessity of cooperation leads to a practice of cooperation. In our last evening in camp, well after the sun had set, a small group of young Inuit roared in on snowmobiles. The rangers greeted them. Cigarettes began to glow. It was cold, but not that cold. The men had been hunting caribou somewhere in the west without luck. Suddenly, one of the newcomers stumbled into the crowd. He was upset and told of a young man who had been riding in the sled he was towing. The passenger had disappeared. He must have fallen off somewhere out on the tundra. Marvin and the other rangers asked for more details, but the young man could only shrug and point. Here was the sort of search and rescue mission the rangers had trained for. But before Atketuk could organize it, a pair of rangers suited up and throttled off. We watched their headlights streak into the darkness, grow fainter, vanish. Then most of us wandered back to our tents to wait and listen for the whine of returning machines. We made tea. Marvin seemed concerned, but not overly so. The missing Inuit had been raised in the Arctic and knew what to do if he found himself alone on the ice. I thought of the bears spotted a couple of days before and tried to imagine what the young man was doing out there. Maybe he was singing hymns. Next in this issue devoted to the Arctic region, we have an article entitled "The Threat Below" by Craig Welch, with photographs by Katie Orlinsky. Arctic permafrost is thawing much faster than expected, reshaping the land and releasing carbon gases that could speed up climate change. And in the first photograph, we have a picture of the Batagaika crater in eastern Siberia. It's half a mile wide and growing. It's the largest of many across the Arctic. As permafrost laced with buried ice thaws, the ground collapses, forming craters or lakes. Well, that is interesting. I just didn't know of that physical phenomenon. The next picture is of a fire, and it's coming out of a hole in the ice. The caption reads, "Methane, a potent greenhouse gas, is bubbling from thawing ground under lakes across the Arctic. In winter, surface ice traps the gas. On this pond near Fairbanks, Alaska, scientists have drilled through the ice and set the escaping methane on fire." Sergei Zimov, an ecologist by training, tossed a woolly mammoth bone on the pile. He was squatting in mud along the cool, wide Kolyma River, below a towering cliff of crumbling earth. It was summer in eastern Siberia, far above the Arctic Circle, in that part of Russia that's closer to Alaska than to Moscow. There wasn't a speck of frost or snow in sight. Yet at this cliff called Duvani Yar, the Kolyma had chewed through and exposed what lies beneath, a layer of frozen ground, or permafrost, that is hundreds of feet deep, and warming fast. Twigs, other plant matter, and Ice Age animal parts, bison jaws, horse femurs, mammoth bones, spilled onto a beach that sucked at Zimov's boots. "I loved Vanayar," he said as he yanked fossils from the muck. "It is like a book. Each page is a story about the history of nature." Across 9 million square miles at the top of the planet, climate change is writing a new chapter. Arctic permafrost isn't thawing gradually, as scientists once predicted. Geologically speaking, it's thawing almost overnight. As soils like the ones at Duvanayar soften and slump, they're releasing vestiges of ancient life and masses of carbon that have been locked in frozen dirt for millennia. Entering the atmosphere as methane or carbon dioxide, the carbon promises to accelerate climate change even as humans struggle to curb our fossil fuel emissions. Few understand this threat better than Zimov. From a ramshackle research station in the gold mining outpost of Chersky, about 3 hours by speedboat from Duvanayar, he has spent decades unearthing the mysteries of a warming Arctic. Along the way, he has helped upend conventional wisdom, especially the notion that the far north, back in the Pleistocene ice ages, had been an unbroken desert of ice and thin soils dotted with sage. Instead, the abundant fossils of mammoths and other large grazers at Duvanayar and other sites told Zimov that Siberia, Alaska, and Western Canada had been fertile grasslands, rich with herbs and willows. As these plants and animals died, the cold slowed their decomposition. Over time, wind-blown silt buried them deep, locking them in permafrost. The upshot is that Arctic permafrost is much richer in carbon than scientists once thought. Now new discoveries suggest that the carbon will escape faster as the planet warms. From the unexpected speed of Arctic warming and the troubling ways that meltwater moves through polar landscapes, researchers now suspect that for every 1 degree Celsius rise in Earth's average temperature, permafrost may release the equivalent of 4 to 6 years' worth of coal, oil, and natural gas emissions, double to triple what scientists thought a few years ago. Within a few decades, if we don't curb fossil fuel use, permafrost could be as big a source of greenhouse gases as China, the world's largest emitter, is today. We weren't accounting for that. The UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change has only recently started incorporating permafrost into its projections. It still underestimates just how wide Pandora's freezer could swing open, and how much havoc that could unleash. Permafrost's potential to warm the planet is dwarfed by our own, but if we hope to limit warming to 2 degrees Celsius, as 195 nations agreed to during the 2015 Paris talks, new research suggests we may have to cut emissions 8 years sooner than IPCC models project, just to account for the thawing that will be going on. It is perhaps our least appreciated reason to hasten a transition to cleaner energy. To reach whatever goal we set to combat warming, we'll need to move even faster than we think. Zimov first came to Chersky in the 1970s as a college student to help with mapping on an expedition. He loved the stark landscape and isolation and remoteness from Soviet power centers. The dark winters promised time to think. He returned a few years later and founded the Northeast Science Station, at first under the auspices of the Russian Academy of Sciences. Today he owns and runs it with his son, Nikita. It's an improvisational operation run on a shoestring and on second-hand equipment, but the station attracts Arctic scientists from around the world. One day, in the summer of 2018, photographer Katie Orlinsky and I joined Zimov in an aging boat to ferry supplies to a carbon monitoring facility at Ambarchik Bay, near the mouth of the Kolyma on the Arctic Ocean. The site had originally been occupied by a transit station for prisoners bound for Stalin's gulags, and Soviet-era relics were everywhere. We traversed spongy grasses across a walkway fashioned from a string of old steam radiators. Zimov, bull-chested, his long white hair tucked in a beret, probed the ground with a metal shaft as he walked. "He's been doing that a lot lately," to check the depth of the hard permafrost. Permafrost, ground that remains frozen year-round, is capped by a few feet of dirt and plant detritus. Called the active layer, this soil normally thaws each summer and refreezes in winter, protecting permafrost from rising heat above. But in the spring of 2018, a crew working for Nikita found that dirt near the surface around Chersky had not iced up at all during the long, dark polar night. That was unheard of. January in Siberia is so brutally cold that human breath can freeze with a tinkling sound that the indigenous Yakuts call the whisper of stars. The Soviets used to land heavy planes on the Kolyma. Soil 30 inches down should have been frozen. Instead, it was mush. 3 years ago, the temperature in the ground above our permafrost was -3 degrees Celsius, 27 degrees Fahrenheit, Sergei Zimov said. Then it was -2, then it was -1. This year, the temperature was +2 degrees. On one level, that's not surprising. Earth's five warmest years since the late 19th century have come since 2014, and the Arctic is warming more than twice as fast as the rest of the planet as it loses the sea ice that helps chill it. In 2017, tundra in Greenland faced its worst known wildfire. Days before we landed in Siberia, thermometers in Lakselv, Norway, 240 miles above the Arctic Circle, recorded a blistering 32 degrees Celsius, or 90 degrees Fahrenheit. Arctic reindeer hid in road tunnels for relief. Permafrost temperatures globally have been rising for half a century. On Alaska's North Slope, they spiked 11 degrees Fahrenheit in 30 years. Localized thawing of permafrost, especially in villages where development disturbs the surface and allows heat to penetrate, has eroded shorelines, undermined roads and schools, cracked pipelines, and collapsed ice cellars where Arctic hunters store walrus meat and bowhead whale blubber. Warm summers are already warping life for Arctic residents. What the Zimovs were documenting in 2018, though, was something different, with implications beyond the Arctic, a wintertime thaw. The culprit, paradoxically, was heavy snow. Siberia is dry, but for several winters before 2018, thick snow had smothered the region. The snow acted like a blanket, trapping summer heat in the soil. At a research site 11 miles from Chersky, Matthias Gürkedy of Germany's Max Planck Institute for Biogeochemistry found that snow depth had doubled in 5 years. By April 2018, temperatures in the active layer had risen 10 degrees Fahrenheit. The phenomenon wasn't limited to Siberia. Vladimir Romanovsky, a permafrost expert at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, had for years watched the active layer freeze completely by mid-January at some 180 research sites in Alaska. But as those places also faced a recent period with heavy snow, the freezing slipped first to February, then to March. In 2018, 8 of Romanovsky's sites near Fairbanks and a dozen on the Seward Peninsula in western Alaska never fully froze at all. Globally, permafrost holds up to 1,600 gigatons of carbon, nearly twice what's in the atmosphere. No one expects all or even most of that to thaw. Until recently, researchers presumed permafrost would lose at most 10% of its carbon. Even that, it was thought, could take as much as 80 years. But when the active layer stops freezing in winter, things speed up. The added warmth lets microbes chomp organic material in the soil and emit carbon dioxide or methane year-round, instead of just for a few short months each summer. And the winter warmth spreads down into the permafrost itself, thawing it faster. A lot of our assumptions are breaking down, said Wassin Coman, an atmospheric chemist at Columbia University, who tracks carbon emissions by airplane. She and her colleagues have discovered that the amount of CO2 coming off Alaska's North Slope in early winter has increased by 73% since 1975. We've been trying to understand what's going on in the Arctic by relying on summer, Coman said. But after the sun goes down, that's when the real story begins. A few snowy winters don't make a trend. This past winter, there was less snow in Chersky, and the soil cooled again considerably. Fairbanks also got little snow. Yet at some of Romanovsky's sites in Alaska, the active layer again retained enough heat to keep from completely freezing. "This is truly amazing," said Max Holmes, deputy director of Massachusetts Woods Hole Research Center, who has studied the carbon cycle in both Alaska and Chersky. "I've largely imagined permafrost thaw as a slow and steady process, and maybe this is an odd 5-year period, but what if it's not? What if things change much more quickly? And what if the change becomes self-reinforcing, as it already is, for example, in the case of Arctic sea ice? Sea ice reflects the sun's rays, keeping the ocean below it cold. But as sea ice melts, the dark ocean absorbs that heat, which then melts more ice. As a rule, the tipping points at which such feedback loops kick in are tricky to predict." "We know there are thresholds we don't want to cross," said Chris Field, director of Stanford University's Woods Institute for the Environment, "but we don't know precisely where they are." "With permafrost, there's just too much we can't see. It covers an area more than twice the size of the United States, inhabited by half as many people as New York City, in some of the world's least accessible terrain. Little of it is monitored directly. Scientists instead study small plots, track others remotely, and draw inferences about the rest, unlike Arctic sea ice, which can be measured in its entirety by satellite. You can go online and track exactly what happened to sea ice," said permafrost expert Ted Schur of Northern Arizona University. "With permafrost, we're barely looking. We barely have the tools to measure what's happening." One type of permafrost has researchers particularly concerned, the 20% or so that contains immense deposits of solid ice. Some of that ice formed when water percolated down through the soils and froze as it hit permafrost. Some of it was created over thousands of years during Arctic winters when the ground contracted and cracked into polygonal patterns. In spring, meltwater filled those crevices, which later refroze. Over time, the buried ice grew into massive wedges enveloped by permafrost soil. Duvaniyar is shot through with them. Such a structure can unravel swiftly. When permafrost disintegrates, buried ice melts too. As water drains, it transports heat that spreads the thawing, and it leaves behind tunnels and air pockets. The ground sinks to fill those cavities, creating surface depressions that fill with rain and meltwater. The water deepens the pools and chews through their icy banks until puddles grow to ponds and ponds become lakes. That causes more ground to warm and more ice to melt. Abrupt thaw, as scientists call this process, changes the whole landscape. It triggers landslides. On Banks Island in Canada, scientists documented a 60-fold increase in massive ground slumps from 1984 to 2013. It topples forests. Merit Turetsky, an ecologist with Canada's University of Guelph, has tracked abrupt thaw in a black spruce forest near Fairbanks for the past 15 years. Flooding there, she has found, is destabilizing tree roots and trunks. Turetsky suspects all the trees in her drunken forest will tip over soon and get swallowed by new wetlands. "There are still little pockets of land, but you have to wade through some pretty wet spots to reach them," she said. All permafrost thaw leads to greenhouse gas emissions, but standing water accelerates the threat. The gas that bubbles from the oxygen-deprived mud under ponds and lakes is not only carbon dioxide, but also methane, which is 25 times as potent a greenhouse gas as CO2. Ecologist Katie Walter Anthony of the University of Alaska Fairbanks has been measuring the methane coming from Arctic lakes for 2 decades. Her latest calculations, published in 2018, suggest that new lakes created by abrupt thaw could nearly triple the greenhouse gas emissions expected from permafrost. It's not clear how much of this message has reached policymakers. Last October, the IPCC unveiled a new report on the more ambitious of two temperature goals adopted at the 2015 Paris conference. The planet already has warmed by about 1 degree Celsius, or 1.8 degrees Fahrenheit, since the 19th century. Capping global warming at 1.5 degrees Celsius rather than 2 degrees, the report said, would expose 420 million fewer people to frequent extreme heat waves, and it would halve the number of plants and animals facing habitat loss. It also might save some coral reefs and as much as 770,000 square miles of permafrost. But to achieve the 1.5-degree goal, according to the IPCC, the world would have to cut greenhouse gas emissions 45% by 2030, eliminate them completely by 2050, and develop technologies to suck huge quantities back out of the atmosphere. The challenge may be even starker. The 1.5-degree report was the first time the IPCC had taken permafrost emissions into account, but it didn't include emissions from abrupt thaw. Climate models aren't yet sophisticated enough to capture that kind of rapid landscape change. But at National Geographic's request, Katie Walter Anthony and Charles Coven, a modeler at the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory, made rough calculations that do add in emissions from abrupt thaw. To halt temperature rise at 1.5 degrees, they estimate, we'd have to zero out our own fossil fuel emissions at least 20% sooner, no later than 2044, 6 years ahead of the IPCC timetable. That would give us just a quarter century to completely transform the global energy system. We're facing this unknown future with an incomplete set of tools, Coven said. The uncertainty isn't all on our side. There are a lot of ways things could turn out worse. There's more than one way to make new lakes, for example. And I think that will be a good spot for us to stop, because a new section starts about that creation of new lakes. So let me go back and just in the little bit of time remaining, choose one of the many beautiful and inspiring dread photos. We see, in a photo, we see some wild horses. And it says the Zemovs believe that large grazing animals helped maintain rich Arctic grasslands during the Ice Age, in part by fertilizing the grass, in hopes of bringing back the dry steppe and also slowing permafrost thaw. They are now importing wild horses and other grazers to a site along a tributary of the Kolyma River. They call it Pleistocene Park. So do your job there, horses. Help us out, because we have a huge task ahead of us. I hope you have a lovely week, and that you'll tune in again next week for more of National Geographic. I'm Susan Shackelford. Thanks for listening.